You're listening to a DayOne.fm show.
Welcome back to Diaspora.nz, where we're on a mission to seek out and profile the hidden gems, the best founders, operators, researchers, and emerging leaders of the great Kiwi expat community. Today, we're talking to Cameron Priest. He's the co-founder and the former CEO of TradeGecko, an inventory and order management platform for e-commerce businesses that was founded in Singapore and acquired by Intuit in 2020 for around $100 million. Cam's now building AMP, a company that acquires, rolls up, and scales Shopify apps, and he's incubating new ventures at the intersection of AI and vertical SaaS. This episode's a little longer than others. We have a lot of ground to cover, including discussing some of the lessons learned from scaling TradeGecko and the specific growth tools, the frameworks they use along the way. We discuss the intricacies of the acquisition itself from the company side, how he positioned himself and pulled the deal across the line, even as the world was falling apart in the depths of the pandemic. We then flip over to the other side of the table and how, as acquirers, AMP assesses, values, and executes an acquisition, including the use of debt and how to think about revenue multiples and how they're looking at where the industry is headed next with the AI boom. And then finally, we jam on what ambition means to Cameron and his advice for folks just setting out on their journeys today. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you want to do something to help the show, please send this episode to a friend, maybe an expat somewhere around the world who you think will enjoy it. And let's get over and stuck into the show. Here's my conversation with Cameron Priest. Cameron Priest, it's an absolute pleasure to be sitting with you here live north of Auckland, having you back in the country temporarily. Thanks for hopping on the Diaspora pod.
Thank you for having me.
Fascinating story. You have been out of the country now for the better part of 15 years.
Trying to do quick math in my head, but yeah, 2012 I left, January 2012.
And it's a little hard to pin down where you are these days and what you're doing. We'll get to that in time, but the large majority of that would have been spent in Singapore.
Yeah, so from 2012 till July last year, so 2023, spent the entire time in Singapore, the first 8.5 years building TradeGecko, and then sold that, and then we all know what happened for a couple of years there with COVID, and then left last year for a bit.
Let's start at the start, because I'm excited to deep dive into a lot of these pieces of the journey, but tell me about, you grew up in a kiwi fruit orchard, three brothers running around starting things. What were the inflection points that you think put you on the path that you're on today?
So one of four, I have three brothers, kiwi fruit orchard down in Mokoroa. I grew up with a father who ran an engineering firm on the property. He also had the kiwi fruit orchard. He was also a volunteer firefighter, but I think the engineering business is the one to focus on. I saw him build and invent great products and frankly never really get paid what he deserved for them. So a number of standard kind of pieces of equipment in the kiwi fruit industry he invented, like some of the trailers. There's something called a soft rider trailer, which he invented. He built products for other people. And he was a great engineer, and I'd say an okay business person. But like, I remember going on a family holiday to Australia, and we went for like a 2-hour detour because mum wanted to try and get someone who'd run, left the country and hadn't paid a $1,000 bill. Mum was definitely a bit of the debt collector in that business, and that wasn't dad's way. He was kind of the, you can't pay me, just give me a box of beers. And so I kind of saw him running a business, having quite a great technical depth of skill and not really capitalizing on that in the way that I thought he should.
Is there a chip on the shoulder there? Like, do you feel like you were conscious of that at the time? Or do you think that's a sort of a lesson more in hindsight?
Definitely conscious all the time. I used to make the refrain that he was a great inventor and not a great entrepreneur. I don't know if that's fair. He was even on a show in like 1988 called Future Millionaire, the TV show in New Zealand. And you see this video of my mum and dad. There's a dog there. They're on the kiwi fruit orchard. He bought the first kiwi fruit orchard when he was 17. He'd kind of done the thing. And even today he says, you know, he had this high hopes. I think maybe he's 85 potentially. And then the 87 kicked his ass with the crash. He had to get three jobs to support the family. And when you talk to him today, he's like, yeah, I just never felt that I could take a risk from then on once he had the kids and once he'd been through that kind of real dark couple of years with the economy. And I guess kiwi fruit is, you know, it is what it is in terms of agriculture. But we had a lot of friends who'd done a lot better in that industry than potentially we had or my family had. But every one of them had been bankrupt at one point. They took the risk on. And dad has just said to me today, like, he just, through that journey and then after having us boys, he just wasn't willing to step up to the plate and swing again at the risk. So he continued to be the business person. But I remember being 13, 14, and he'd be finishing one job to go to the job in the cool storage to pack kiwi fruit and drive forklift. Like, he did have three jobs for a while. And so, yeah, I think all of that kind of culminated in me going, like, there are better ways to do this. And then I saw that he was great at building things, just not translating that necessarily to wealth.
The kiwi fruit industry is notorious for having some of that boom and bust life cycle.
I think all commodities, yeah.
Yeah, I'd say some people can have varying effects. So in one case, it might actually create more of a risk adversity and they'll be more security conscious, looking for the more stable quality of life. And sounds like in your father's point in his life, that was the thing. In others, it can breed almost like a desire to take more risk or an appetite for risk or a normalization of risk that they can take with them into their career. Would it be accurate to say that you've got the latter? You've certainly got a desire to take risk.
It's always an interesting question with entrepreneurs. Do I want risk, or like, I'm inclined to remove all risks? But I'm definitely a lot more risk on, or I definitely was earlier. And I think when I first started, I had nothing to lose. The risk was completely comfortable. You know, what am I risking? Nothing. Now I'm kind of in a position where I'm also comfortable taking risks because I have enough to backstop me. So I may have been very lucky that I never had that place in time where I had something to lose and I had a chance of losing it. At first, I had nothing to lose. And now that I have a family and things to worry about, I've got enough to take risks with. So I've never had that 87 crash, I have to work three jobs moment in my life. So it's hard to say.
I hope you never do, to be honest. Yeah. But young Cameron, age 23, if I recall, you were hanging out in New Zealand, thinking about what you could possibly build, and TradeGecko might have been a sparkle in your eye. If that, take us and put us in your shoes in that moment.
So I was running a design agency with a good friend of mine, Carl Thompson, up in Auckland. And we were working on a few different contract jobs, building kind of small web apps. Facebook apps was the hot thing at the time. But we had one client who wanted us to help them build a sales application on the iPad that had just come out. And they wanted that to be integrated into NetSuite. We saw this market opportunity, and I think this was just purely around the fact that, I don't know if you remember, but between like 2007 and 2010 when the iPhone came out, for the first time, I think a lot of people had a device which had really high quality software. And so the contrast to the software that they used in their business became very stark. Mm. So we're like, oh, software can be like this? I didn't realize. And so every consumer was like, oh, and maybe it was 2009, 2010 by the time iPhone got to New Zealand in any big way. But you're like, oh, this is the standard I should expect. And we had the whole bring your device to work movement that kind of occurred. And I think a lot of people said, oh, well, if I can do that at home on my little, you know, beautiful little device, why am I doing this shitty thing at work? Like, why do I have to put up with the spreadsheet? Why do I have to put up with some manual process? And so that was the opportunity we saw. And we particularly saw it in the space of seeing people interact with this platform called NetSuite, which is a very large ERP / accounting software platform now owned by Oracle. I remember meeting with some people where, you know, we had a two-person company that sold some sort of window cleaning equipment and they were spending 50 grand a year on this platform. Xero and VendHQ were big inspirations at that stage. And so we thought there was an opportunity to build something for that market, you know, kind of an accessible cloud-based, you know, platform for brands, retailers, wholesalers, etc. Commerce players. That was kind of the genesis. It sounds smooth. I'm sure there's 12, 24 months of kind of...
There's probably a fancy label you could put on the hindsight, like a consumerization of business software or something.
There was definitely that flip, right? Where we went from you use software at work, you didn't really use software at home outside of email and internet. And then you got a phone where you're like, oh, apps can be great actually. And then the expectations from everything else you interacted with became very high.
And of course, 2009, this is now 2019. This is probably not the best time to be raising capital in New Zealand. And so you were looking offshore.
I don't know if that was a me thing. Oh, it was definitely a New Zealand thing and definitely a me thing. There wasn't a lot around. This was when Icehouse was still charging 50 grand to join the incubator or whatever it was. You know, the very not so nice side of the industry. And yeah, so went offshore. So at that stage, the incubator craze was the hot thing. There's probably 1,000 incubators popping up around the world, all inspired by Y Combinator. And we applied to Startmate in Sydney. We applied to Y Combinator in San Francisco. I believe they were in San Francisco at the time. And JFDI in Singapore. And Startmate, it was a pretty quick no. YC was, I think it was an interview question. You come in for the interview at that time. And I don't know how they do it today. And then JFDI was like, yep, you're in. And so we were like, oh, well, there's $15,000. Sounds like a lot of money to us. Let's go. And so there wasn't really a lot of extra thinking.
It's going to represent a pretty good investment for them in the end of the story as well, I believe.
Yeah, I think, I mean, their total fund over 80 portfolio companies, 82 portfolio companies, maybe they invested $3 to $4 million. And I think we may have doubled or tripled that.
And the curious thing here was that you weren't necessarily in Singapore or for Southeast Asia specifically, as other startups were starting to appear to do so. You were building a global product. You just happened to be co-located in Singapore.
Yeah, we always would say that we were just a global company headquartered in Singapore. That's a bit of a turn of phrase and it sounds good. You know, there were lots of reasons and lots of issues with that. I'd say it'd be a lot easier today, but definitely mistakes were made and our customer base was clearly the North American Western top 8 markets, the top English speaking markets, as you'd expect.
So I'm curious on the reflection now, having had exposure to that market, had you ever considered building for the Southeast Asian space or you had friends that were building out
there? We talked about it. It definitely became something we considered, we explored. Even today, I'd say building software for the Southeast Asian market is probably not a great business model. Mm-hmm. There's just an ability to hire cheap staff to do a lot of manual process work. And even today, I think, you know, some of the great SaaS companies that have come out of India don't even really focus on India. You know, they're focused mm-hmm. on the North American markets. And there haven't been probably, you know, maybe there's one or two decent SaaS companies out of Southeast Asia, but it's not a market that adopts software really or is willing to pay for it. We we have a few great ones from there now. PatSnap, which is a big patent multi-billion dollar unicorn. But as I said, I can't think of, you know, five great software companies out of Southeast Asia today that go global.
So give us a snapshot through the journey. TradeGecko, as it's going through its fastest growth phases through into the 2020-2021 era that I know was quite consequential.
Lots of peaks and troughs. So 2012, landed in Singapore, did the incubator. End of that year, early the next year, raised our seed round. At that time, there's a lot of government support for the venture industry. Still is, but at a different level. And we were able to raise just under $1 million from a local VC. We ran pretty quick with that. The $1 million in, we ran from, in 2013, 80K to 1.1 million by mid the year after. So within 13, 14 months, we went, you know, 80K to 1.1, and that enabled us to raise $6.5 million on an 18.5 pre. And yeah, end of the day, we were building this global business. I mean, it's hard. I mean, it's such a long period of time, frankly, to compress it, but lots of mistakes, lots of kind of go-to-market failures, lots of missteps in terms of, you know, thinking we were ready to go into new markets.
What's your biggest one? What's your biggest regret if you could take the time machine back and kick Cameron in the ass?
I'd say the biggest one was just the most obvious one that everyone always talks about, which is we had product market fit in a market. We were snapping necks, cashing checks, and then we thought we had product market fit in markets we didn't. So we tried to scale and accelerate a model that we had kind of really humming in certain subsets of ICPs, and we thought it was broadly applicable. So we went from kind of great economics, great lifetime value to going, well, we have to hit bigger numbers. And the way to do that is to try and serve more and more types of customers when we probably should have served the same customers with more and more, serve them better, higher checks. But instead, we broadened the platform and the kind of the thesis of who we could support without really providing the same level of depth. And that also made a product worse for the customers that really, truly did love and appreciate the product. So it's a classic taking the eye off the ball, of the ball being the ICP, trying to say, we have this massive inbound machine. Let's build everything that everyone wants. And let's try and use the same brushstrokes to attract everyone. It took us years to realize we were just pumping customers in. Churn got worse. Retention, obviously the flip side of that. And then the product became kind of very horizontally broad and maybe 2 centimeters deep when it needed to be 2 feet deep. And realistically, through all that time, we were stuffing all the customers in the top of the funnel. We're adding new integrations. And some of that was valuable, but there was no method to that madness. It was just come what may, customers want to use us, they want to pay us, let's bring them on. The long-term consequences of that, if you have this large customer base of customers with many different expectations, you're okay for everyone and not great for anyone.
This is brilliant. Now, to refine that into a piece of advice, it could be better define the ICP and be prepared to fire the customers that don't fit that. Be prepared to say, sorry, we can't serve you. We're actually focused on X.
And I'll give the specific tactical thing we did in 2019. It was kind of the whole idea of never let a good crisis go to waste. We mapped very specifically 32 different customer profiles. And we said two of these are what we call super green. Six of these are green. And we had very specific things about what defined each of those different types of segments. Then we had the next 16 being orange and the next remainder being red. And we said, we don't build for red. We don't talk to red. We don't sell to red. We tell red, please go away. We say to orange, I'm sorry, not right now. Maybe come back to us in a year. But a sales rep can't close a red or an orange lead. And every decision inside the company, the language, the verbiage we used was like, how is this making your green lives better or super green? Measurably, how are we going to make their lives better? And maybe once a year, we might talk about, is there an orange segment that we should try and flip to green? And what does that truly mean? What is it going to cost us? But it was always weighed up against making green, super green, focusing on those guys.
What were the super greens? And define them by, say, stage. Are these SMEs or are these enterprises?
Yeah, you know, these are SMEs. These are between $500,000 in revenue. Within that eight green, I would say between 500K and 20 million, but obviously we'd never be that broad. We'd say 500K to 2 million in New Zealand, selling wholesale, selling beer to 120 pubs. And they need three things. They need payments that flow through our platform. They need to have a portal where their pubs can log in online and place orders directly. And maybe they sell on Shopify, but Shopify is only 18% of their business. It's not the 100% of the business. So we had these very specific variables, maybe 10 to 12 variables per customer segment. And we knew what we had to do to succeed. A complete counterexample would be, probably super red, would be someone who had 13 Shopify stores. They're on 12 different marketplaces, because what they really needed was a high velocity transaction engine to take orders from many different places, synchronize them, keep the stock levels up to date, and make sure they weren't selling goods they didn't have in stock. That's a fine business, but it was really about, I mean, if you think about what that problem they're trying to solve, it's a very different problem from someone who's saying, no, I have a wholesale business that I want to run. I want to process payments through you. So in the wholesale business, we were selling money. We were the platform through which they engaged with their customers and collected payments, which is a beautiful place to be. For the Shopify platform, it's technically very difficult. And the problem was trying to charge, having a pricing model that suited both. The one with 32 sales channels, there's a place to serve them, but you should be charging them $25,000 a month. And it's a really high performing team focused on that specific problem. But if you tried to jam both of those into the same product, how do you price for both those segments? You can't. You can't say to the guy doing wholesale, it's 25 grand a month to run your beer business doing 1.2 million. It shouldn't be. It should be a $200 or $400 a month product. But we had people doing both.
For the former group, for the beer distributor, how are you filling the funnel? How do you think about the sales motion, the go-to-market motion to acquire them as efficiently as possible? And again, you you've learned a lot. Yep. You've moved on a lot since then. Imagine in your time machine, you can give Cameron 2018 some advice. What are you telling him?
So we had a great inbound content marketing machine. And this is when that was still a relatively new thing when we started in 2012. HubSpot was...
So you're optimizing your SEO. You're
huge amount of that. Hundreds of thousands of visitors, high quality content, lead funnels, free tools, free apps. We built free iPhone apps. We built free Shopify apps. We built free all sorts of different things. So creating a lot of different levels of intent, content, and valuable tools. We went to the partner channel. Xero had a really well-established partner channel. We were less successful with the QuickBooks partner channel, which two partners of ours, and obviously a final acquirer was QuickBooks into it. Potentially, that was a mistake from us. We didn't really double down on the US, but obviously the partner-led channel. I mean, if you're a small business or SME, quite often the person you go to for financial advice is the accountant. Put aside whether that's the right thing to do.
Do you have any advice for thinking about partner channel or platform style channel growth mechanisms today? If someone is on the Salesforce platform, or if they're on the Xero or QuickBooks platform today, how much should they be relying or building into those?
Yeah, once again, it's hard because it's changed quite dramatically. When we started, Shopify was doing 12 million ARR. So we kind of grew with them very dramatically. I do make a joke to my VCs, we should have just invested in them and gotten to the beach. We'd have all made a lot more money and had a lot easier time of it. But we effectively rode their coattails as, you know, one of the first deeply integrated partners that integrate with that platform. Somewhat true for Xero, but Shopify obviously has just outstripped everyone. And obviously it's the overall arc of history that is e-commerce growth online was a great source of growth for us. And then I think just the adoption of cloud software. We were one of the few early platforms that did what we did in the space that we did it. Nowadays, there's a lot more options.
So you spoke about QuickBooks, and to some extent, I think Xero's appearance onto the scene kind of wakened the sleeping giants and into it, and they started very heavily investing in QuickBooks. And there's a saying that great companies are bought, not sold.
Mm-hmm.
You were acquired by Intuit into the QuickBooks commerce product platform offering, I believe. Walk us through how that happened. Were you out there fundraising and actually the acquisition appeared? Were you out there trying to get sold? Or
it's funny. We had been going through a process to figure out if there was a home. We'd been in parallel looking at both trying to find a home and also potentially merging with a competitor and maybe listing on the ASX. And
give us a snapshot of the business at that point as well. You were tens, 20s, millions of ARR.
High teens. And with a merger, we would have probably been 30 to 40. And that would have been enough to be a sub, maybe a half a billion ASX AUD market cap. At that time, the multiples on the market might be very different right now.
2019, 20 was a different world.
Yeah. 2018, 2019. Yeah, exactly. There was a lot of demand. In fact, through 2020, we might have popped, but I think we'd be in a very different state right now. And actually, none of that really worked. We talked to all the players. We talked to lots of people. There was some interest. There was some, I'll call them offers with air quotes, because they weren't what I would consider to be a proper offer. And there was a couple of reasons why we were doing that. Partly it was just, I was getting tired. I was kind of trying to figure out what's the next acceleration for this business. We were growing 70, 80% a year. There wasn't a path for us to re-accelerate to 100, 200% without another capital raise and kind of a refounding moment. There were a couple of reasons why that occurred. Partly the biggest one would be that our biggest partners commoditized us in a little bit. Shopify launched an increasingly higher quality version of inventory management. So did Xero, which took out kind of the breath of the wind in our sails for the smaller segment, which is kind of the higher volume, lower value, but kind of easy PLG customers.
Is that something you could have seen coming?
We definitely saw it coming, but we didn't know how to defend against it. And we thought we were defending against it. And we were doing things in terms of, if you're a pure Shopify store, we weren't trying to serve you. You can just, Shopify was good enough. And so if you're a wholesaler, and that was definitely one of the big drivers for us to do this whole ICP work that I mentioned, was we knew this was coming. We need to figure it out. And we did start to do bigger upmarket deals, but there was also just a, we had to reignite this thing and we hadn't figured that out at that stage.
I mean, if there is an answer to this for a founder who's facing their product being commoditized by a platform they work with, it's really going to be pick your ICP and serve them incredibly well.
Yeah. And we were starting to do that. We'd turned off features. We'd kind of shrunk back. We'd gone from 400 net new customers a month to kind of 200. And we knew that retention rate on that 200 was kind of, you know, 110% versus maybe 80% with others. So like we were making these calls alongside kind of figuring out. So we're trying to run multiple strategies, frankly. And then, yeah, back to the acquisition. So the actual acquisition, the way it occurred, I think it was sometime in December or November 2019, I get a LinkedIn message from a VP of corporate development at Intuit. And he effectively just says something to the effect of, did you see my email?
Yeah.
And I'm like, of course, in my normal way, I did not. I went into my inbox in spam. There was an email. It's a nicely worded email. I think I still have somewhere. And it said something to the effect of, hey, wanted to reach out and chat about what you're working on. We're really interested in the space. I saw that my team engaged with you in 2014. Like, I'm the biggest dumbass in the world. Would love to chat about you guys. And rapidly said, yeah, I would love to chat. And kind of two first quick lessons. One, the fact that I wasn't engaging with, I think they were our second biggest partner. I didn't have any deep relationships with anyone there. I mean, I was going to the States and I wasn't, I mean, I clearly should have had meaningful relationships with these people. And I didn't.
With corp devs specifically or just?
I just think anyone, because frankly, corp dev works for the business. So they were told to go do something. And so as soon as we talked to them, they flew a VP of engineering from the QuickBooks business out to see us for a 2-hour meeting to Singapore. he did a red eye and he was a little bit kind of jet lagged, and we had an amazing meeting. This is like just before Christmas was knocking off for the Christmas break, but he met with myself, the CTO, the chief design officer, and two senior engineers, or two kind of heads of engineering. And we just vibed. And he's a great guy. And he was kind of saying, look, we have this initiative. We've had this initiative for 10 years. We've swung at it a few times, which is that QuickBooks is a great product for service businesses, but we can't really serve businesses that sell products well. And so we want to. You could see in their history, they bought a competitor maybe 5 years ago. They tried to build a product 2 or 3 years ago, and it just hadn't worked. And so they're trying to swing at it again. And yeah, so we started that conversation and we came out to the Valley. We weren't allowed on campus because this thing called COVID had just appeared in the world. This was end of January, I think. I hung out there, went down to Carmel, pretended to have other meetings in the Valley, but really just stuck to being on call for Intuit. Mm. And then I think the day Tom Hanks got COVID in Australia, I'll never forget, Wednesday, we get a call and we say, guys, it's off. The deal's off. We love you guys. We think what you're doing is great, but it's come from upon high. Nothing's happening. Everything's shutting down.
At that point, the markets were shutting down. The market cap was plummeting.
Yeah, everything was plummeting. We didn't know what was going to happen, right? So the world shut. It was March 8th, I think, it was a Friday. And then I stayed till the Monday and I sent my wife home and the kids. So we knew the borders were closing. And then I went home to Singapore. And obviously, I was pretty freaking frustrated. Mm. We had some other issues coming up in terms of some convertible notes that we're having some issues with some shareholders related to the fact that we were going to try and list. And that was looming. The beautiful thing I did, which in hindsight was probably the thing that saved the relationship, I'd met the SVP, I think his title was Alex Chris, who's now the CEO of PayPal. And I just kept him up to date. I said, hey, here's what's going on with our business and what's going on in the industry. Here's what we're seeing in e-commerce just generally. Mm. So if you got to remember in that time, kind of March to April, the entire world was trying to understand what this meant for them and for, you know, their families, for their businesses. And I was just like, hey, wow, like we're seeing this massive growth in this area here. And here's some interesting data we're seeing over here. Just really trying to cement that we were the experts that had an opinion. And I probably sent maybe 4 to 5 of those. I think it was like 2 to 3 emails, 1 or 2 WhatsApp messages, just trying to keep them appraised. Each one probably 7 to 10 lines, and spent 3 days writing it because for me, it was super important to him. He probably glanced at it and thought, whatever. And he said, oh, thanks for that. That's really interesting. And so we did that a few times. And then I think it was mid to late April, someone reached out and said, hey, this COVID thing, it looks like, you know, we kind of figured out what was going to happen. We're going to get locked down a bit. And e-commerce is booming.
Mm. And everyone's going to be buying online for a while. They probably need to be able to figure out their inventory.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they were like, we would like to talk again. And then we started talking. It took a little while. I guess the end of July, they're like, we want to do this deal. And so we started DD 30 days from 1st of August to the end of August.
Before we get into it, I want to double click on the first engagement, because the dark thought that I had when you said, you know, they reached out, they flew the VP engineering out. Corp dev is notorious for almost like espionage, if you want to put it in the worst sense of it. Like, are they out here to see what you've built so they can build it themselves? Like, how did you de-risk that?
Pretty public about the fact that they were talking to some other direct competitors. So they're talking to a company in the Valley called Stitch Labs. And in fact, at the time and even after the case, because I've kind of kept in contact with a few of the key executives who have now left as well, they said, like, we would have much preferred to have bought a local player, made their life a lot easier. They're around the corner, down the street. They actually ended up getting bought by Square, which is now Block, obviously.
Right.
In terms of that, I probably played a little bit of open hand poker. You know, I wasn't trying to be super nefarious. And I think that was an engaging way of kind of building a relationship with the VP. He was a VP engineering, the guy that we engaged with, right? He wasn't really a corp dev guy. He's now the CTO of LegalZoom. Just a great all-round guy. And so I didn't feel that way. Maybe that was a strategy on his part. So we were as open as we could be. But of course, we didn't hide anything. But of course, we wanted to talk about what we were great at, what our strengths were. We weren't kind of showcasing our weaknesses straight away or anything like that.
Yeah. Did you pitch yourselves into the vision of the future, or were you thinking more about the asset that you'd built and this asset could be
valuable?
No,
we were
valuable.
Pitching what we could do together.
Yeah.
They had 7 million customers. I think about 30 or 40% of them, I can't remember the numbers are public, of them are product businesses. So it's a substantial base of customers that they weren't serving necessarily as well as they wanted to. We talked about the growth of Shopify. We talked about the growth of e-commerce and that opportunity to be the platform that those businesses run on, and how together we could achieve that. They were pitching that to us. We were pitching that to them. So we're well aligned on that. And we pretty rapidly went and read all the transcripts of the quarterly earnings. And, you know, we looked at all the analyst reports. We could see that was where they were going as well.
You out there playing the field, not as soon as QuickBooks is at the table, I'm sure Xero would want to get the table. Was there like an intentional, let's make sure we're getting the highest price for this type of mentality?
We talked to Xero previously. They had for the first time just hired a corp dev person because they'd done an acquisition that there was quite a lot of internal turmoil about how poorly it had gone. And frankly, it was obvious very quickly that they had no idea how to acquire anyone. I believe that's changed. I've had a few CEOs since. But I mean, you can see some of the previous divestments they've made. You know, in the last few years, they've also kind of divested some acquisitions they've made. We probably retagged them in an email thread just in FYI, but their engagement was low to none. So frankly, we didn't. We definitely talked about who else could compete. Was it a PayPal? Was it a BigCommerce? You know, we did have those kind of touch points. But we didn't get a second guy in the running, or second kind of company in the running, frankly. Nothing real.
Do you think on reflection of the process, is there anything coming up to this point? And let's say like up until the signing of the letter of intent or whatever the culminating of the transaction was, what could you and your time machine have done differently?
I mean, look, to your point, having a deep relationship with a few key partners would have been valuable. And we just didn't have that. That was a mistake. It's one of those things where probably never seems like the most important thing to a CEO, which is like, where are my biggest partners and what is their kind of plans? And obviously being public companies, they talk about them, but we weren't digesting that regularly at the way we should have been. We obviously tracked Shopify very closely, but we weren't really tracking the other players. And then the obvious one is just having more relationships because since we got acquired, I think four or five of our competitors, I use the competitor word loosely, all got acquired as well. PE funds kind of came out of the woodwork. There's some roll-ups kind of like we were thinking about doing. So there was clearly appetite and demand, especially around the COVID e-commerce rush that happened. But potentially because we were early to that, we were one of the first ones to get away, maybe the first one, and because we didn't have the deeper relationships to not make it competitive. But I'd say those would be the two things, having the deep relationships with the kind of strategics and having the deep relationships with potential acquirers outside of the strategic. Not always that easy to know which PE fund is going to enter the space though.
This is a really useful also segue from chapter one of your story through into chapter two. So there's the acquisition that went through and there's a little bit of the operating inside the belly of the beast, which could be useful to dig into. But in fact, it was while on the other side that you were already out there brainstorming your next business. And I know that the next business seems like there was sort of the combination of a couple of insights. One was that there was still opportunities that you wanted to run after in e-commerce. And the other was that actually there was something about like the M&A toolkit, something about the rolling up and the capital structure. If you think about innovation on a technology lens versus innovation through a capital structure lens. And in this, let's say chapter two, which is AMP, you wanted to innovate on the capital lens. Is that a good observation of the, you know, the two threads you're combining? Give us sort of a lay of the land of chapter two.
Yeah, sure. I think there was a couple of key takeaways that I had kind of left with. Firstly was just, I had just a general fascination with business, you know, full stop. So I study and kind of look at a lot of things in that space. And one of my biggest takeaways is that there's really two mechanisms in business. There's building and there's financial engineering. And I thought that having both tools in the tool belt would give me an increasing advantage in any game that I wanted to play. So I wanted to learn how to buy companies. I hadn't done them before. Anyone can learn it. It's not rocket science, but there are some interesting nuances to it that were very different from building a software platform. And so I kind of wrote a list of like, what did I want to learn next? Like I literally wrote three things out. And one was I wanted to learn how to buy companies in a repeatable, scalable way. It was something I've been fascinated by. And I think, as I said, it's a tool in the tool belt. Two, I wanted to learn how to use debt to increase my leverage and reduce my dilution, especially if we're buying profitable businesses. And three, I wanted to learn how to build a company without being the CEO day to day. I had a great friend of mine, one of my best friends who used to work for me. He had an exit of his own in a company he'd founded. He was also finishing his earn out. And so as he was finishing his earn out, we started to have this conversation, what are we going to do next? And the opportunity that we saw, was that in the space I'd been playing, which is software for e-commerce, which was not necessarily a game I personally wanted to devote, you know, the next 10 years of my life to, because I'd kind of just run that race. But I saw that there was an opportunity to make a lot of money and maybe have a lot of impact and potentially get some of the team back together. And that opportunity was, you know, in the Shopify ecosystem and e-commerce more generally, but let's stick to Shopify. There was 11,000 Shopify apps. These are businesses that are kind of built on top of the Shopify platform. And, you know, think of them like iPhone apps. They're apps on top of the Shopify, you know, platform, like on your phone. And they increase their functionality, extend what you can achieve with the Shopify product. And I'd recently seen a friend sell a company on the Shopify platform for $110 million. He owned 100% of it. It was 4.5 years old. And I thought, well, like we sold companies for about the same valuation and he owned 100% of his company. And he was able to do that because go-to-market was kind of covered by the fact that he was just plugging into the platform. The platform gave him the growth. And so we saw that there was a number of these businesses that were doing single digit to double digit to, you know, tens of millions of revenue. They were profitable. They were run by great founders. They were bootstrapped. But if you're running a $5 million business doing $2 million EBITDA, or even a $20 million business doing $5 million EBITDA, that doesn't mean you have any money. You probably could take some dividends, especially at the larger scale. But a lot of the time, there's some basic playbooks and some basic kind of mechanisms. So we thought there was an opportunity to kind of build this kind of HubSpot for e-commerce, this kind of integrated great platform, this great suite. But we wanted to buy companies to get there faster. So we did an acquisition, and within the moment we closed that deal, we had 5,000 paying customers to whom we could then spend a lot of time understanding their needs, their pains. We could sell them more products. And that was just a really nice way to start, you know, at stage three, instead of having to figure it all out. And we could buy a business doing $1 million revenue with $500,000 EBITDA, and we could buy it for $2 million.
I love that we've got to this point and we can now reflect back on the Trade Gecko journey where you can say, actually, the thing we could have done better is focus on one ICP and doing one thing for a very specific customer. Yeah. And now you're saying, well, actually, we've got lots of different products and lots of different ICPs and lots of different ways we can serve them. We can sell those products through the same channels. Is that right?
I'd say we focus on fewer types of customers. We focus on a really specific e-commerce brand who uses Shopify. We focus on a brand that's doing between 200K and realistically 10 million. We have some multi-hundred million dollar businesses, but actually the difference is the revenue doesn't really change the profile of the ICP, because the definition of the ICP should be the complications or the complexity of their business. It doesn't really matter if they're doing 5 million or 100 million, if the day-to-day operations are the same and the requirements are the same for the products. I'd say the other key variable we play with is we wanted to sell money or compliance. So Xero sells compliance. You better file your taxes, otherwise you might have someone knocking at your door. Shopify sells money. You pay them $100, you make 10 million, you make 10,000, you make 100 million. You pay them a bit of money and you make way more money from their platform, from the value they're creating. We'd kind of done a little bit of that. We sold money to some subsets of ICPs, but we also just sold efficiency, time. That sucks. Selling money or selling compliance, you know, selling tax filing software sounds boring, but it's critical. Selling money is like, you pay me 100, I make you 1,000. So that was kind of another guiding principle of what we wanted to build and buy.
So to reframe this a bit then, Amped is in the business of acquiring Shopify applications or Shopify ecosystem players, which are in the business of helping retailers on the Shopify platform become more compliant.
So I would put it a different way though. We've got a major in building and a minor in buying. So what we've done is we've bought what we would call landing pads or launch pads, and then we've built great product around them. So we've bought these products. All of them have been doing single digit millions at least. And then we've taken our skill sets around how to do go to market, how to do sales, marketing, customer support, and product. Product is probably the expertise of the business. And we've built significantly bigger, better, greater products and created a huge amount of value for the customers. We've also done the basics, like we, you know, chop wood, carry water. We do pricing that scales with the customer success. But, you know, we now have two primary businesses. One is an analytics business that we acquired, and one is an upsell product that we built. So actually our two business pillars, one is an acquisition, but the other one we built from scratch. But those businesses are fed by a couple of other apps that we acquired, which have thousands of leads, thousands of customers a month coming onto those platforms that we can kind of feed into this platform that we're now developing. And so that I said, that's the, we'll call it the HubSpot for e-commerce. I think 5 years from now, say we're doing, you know, 150 to 200 million ARR, you'd imagine a product that has 5 to 8 product lines. You know, it's like HubSpot. You come for the marketing suite and you stay for the customer support product. You come for the CRM, you expand into another automation product. And we see this world where we can be number 1, 2, or 3 in kind of 5, 8, 10 categories. Each category can do between 10 to 30 to $50 million each. They won't all be the same size, but some will be higher margin, some will be higher volume. They'll feed each other and they'll be in this kind of really integrated platform. For example, our analytics business that we acquired is now deeply integrated into our upsell product. So it's powering the insights. So we are weaving the threads between the products. So there's a natural reason for these products to belong together.
To what extent are the teams themselves, the people building them, all integrated?
The products are functional teams. Each product line has a business unit leader who's a product leader, and then they're supported by a little bit of a central engineering team, and then there's a centralized marketing umbrella over top. And then we have a sales team for one business unit. We don't have a sales team for the second one. And then we have some other apps that are getting a little bit less love because they're not as critical for our go-forward strategy. But again, by the end of this year, we'll probably have 3 primary product pillars. By the end of next year, 5. And, you know, it's really about some shared services, but the product and the sales for each business unit is focused on that product and serving them. And then the shared services is thinking about, well, where does it intuitively make sense for us to attach these products? We don't want to replatform or integrate for the sake of integrating, but, you know, it does make sense when there's some sort of unique insight and a customer can click a button and, you know, automatically propagate that insight into some beneficial way onto their store.
The acquisitions piece, I mean, you're putting yourself in the shoes of the Intuit VP engineering who came out to visit you. You're now going out to visit your customers, sorry, your potential acquisitions. How do you find them? What is the process you'd use to build trust and relationships with them to figure out who you're going to close on? Do you have a pipeline of like you need to cram X number of prospective acquisitions in to see one of them come out?
Look, we've talked to hundreds and hundreds of great founders of these different businesses. I think we've only so far bought bootstrap businesses. We've talked to a lot of funded businesses, but the expectations in terms of the capital they've raised and the valuation of their business is a little bit of a gap right now. Although there's some conversations that are reopening from say 12 months ago where there's maybe some adjustment in their expectations. But yeah, we're talking to founders all the time. We have a gentleman who's looking after that full time. He's talking to maybe 30 or 40 a week, and we're getting kind of a pipeline report.
You're buying them outright, or you're looking at sort of progressive buyout over time?
No, we're doing 100% buyout. It's predominantly cash up front. Potentially there's some earnout. It's not tied to performance. It's tied to kind of some time. That's predominantly just because sometimes we can't afford to pay it up front, or we don't want to because it makes more sense for us to pay over time. That may be tied to retention, but not to performance. And, you know, obviously it just makes it easier for us to balance our capital requirements when we are acquiring these larger businesses. And to your point, what we're doing now is we're strategically looking at the adjacencies to our current competitive advantage. Where do we have a right to position a new product to our customers because of some value we're already creating? And that's why we have two pillars, even though we've done a few more acquisitions than that, because we've really doubled down on the products that make a lot of sense together. And so we're trying to buy right now, I'd say of the two we have, the analytics and the upsell, there's kind of three or four really obvious products that we can kind of tag in beside them. And we're trying to buy and or build those products right now. And then we'll kind of expand that. What we realized is we had a product kind of in the same value chain, a shipping product, but it was just like five or six steps removed. It didn't intuitively make sense that you'd be using an analytics platform and then have a shipping product recommended to you. You can kind of squint and see it, but it didn't feel natural. So we said, hey, this is a great business, but let's not try and force something that didn't feel right for us or for the customer. And said, no, let's focus on, you know, analytics and upsell makes a lot of sense. And then we can kind of see, well, maybe subscription sits right beside it, or maybe there's another product that sits beside it, loyalty. And so we kind of thought, let's focus on that. And also makes our life in terms of upsell and cross-sell a lot easier, because we can, as I said, weave the story about why these products exist under the same family a lot more nicely.
There'd actually be a similar process, or certainly analogous progress, in a tech company that's thinking about, well, we've built this first product, now we're going to build the second product. Exactly. We want to build a second product that's going to be complementary and be able to be supportive. And
100% agree. Yeah,
and you're going to be, you know, the difference is you're acquiring them. Now, you mentioned one of the things getting into this, one was learning to do M&A, the other was debt. And I'm curious, like, if you're paying cash up front to acquire assets like this, what have you learned on the debt front?
So frankly, up till now, we haven't used debt. We're looking at one right now that we're probably going to use a bit of leverage for. It has significant cash flow. Firstly, debt's stressful. We're learning that. We know that. It's obviously intuitively true. We've had venture debt before. What are we learning? Well, we're learning that if you're buying cash flowing profitable assets, actually debt's, it's not easy, but it's straightforward. There's an entire industry set up to support this. And in some ways, I would suggest the biggest thing we learned was that if you want to use debt to buy companies, you actually need to go bigger. Like, it's actually almost impossible to raise debt to buy a smaller company, at least in our situation. Whereas there's a Graham Hart quote, which is you want to buy the biggest assets that you can, leverage it up, and then drive it as hard as you can. And frankly, the first acquisitions we did weren't big enough to justify debt or to kind of bring in debt partners. And I think my biggest takeaway was like, oh, debt providers are in the job of selling debt. I remember I spoke to one debt provider. He's like, look, we'd love to work with you guys. We need to see you commit to taking down at least 150 million, 35 million a year. And we need to see that you can deploy that. And I'm like, I don't necessarily want to commit to that right now. I want to do a couple of deal by deal. But because, well, what is their job? Their job is to have capital out there earning interest. They're not on the job of kind of kicking your ass and turning you over, but they'll put a company into liquidation to get their last $100 back if that's what's required. So that's the flip side of that. You have to really think that through. But as I said, I'd say those are the biggest one right now is the size and the scale of the opportunities that we probably should go after if we really want to leverage up is larger. And that's something we're just getting comfortable with, frankly. We're not there yet. We're looking at it closely right now. I wouldn't say it's still a large deal, but it is fascinating to think it's going to be much easier to raise $100 million of debt than it is to raise 10.
You sent me an article at one point recently. It was by a guy called Theodore Sutherland. And to put a quote that was up the top of it, having worked in venture-backed companies and VC, I've seen the limits of VC for building enduring businesses and capex-heavy businesses, often in the real economy. Curious if, like, a reflection on that would be that, yes, you've raised some VC so far, you've been looking at some debt, but what comes after those?
What comes after those? So look, I mean, hopefully cash flow. So I think cash flow to a degree. I think there's two things. We have raised a fair amount of equity so far. We've been very lucky that the investors that backed my first company were excited and comfortable backing this new adventure. Again, back to the dilution question, debt, whilst it increases risk, it increases potential return, hence leverage. So we will continue to use debt conservatively. The way that we think about it is, you know, you maybe have two or three turns of debt, which would be the multiple of EBITDA that you'd be willing to take on. And then you pay that down and then you do another acquisition, and you leverage up again, and you kind of build this kind of pattern and repeatability and kind of confidence in yourself. And obviously the lenders build confidence in you as well. But frankly, we are only buying profitable businesses. So we get to this kind of threshold, not too far away, where realistically, we do have some what I'll call fixed costs, quote unquote, which again is the top co, the company, the executive team, and the team that's servicing the business units. But each business unit is already profitable and they need to continue to be so. And then once you amortize that top co cost over enough customers and revenue, that revenue can grow, you know, linearly or super linearly, but your cost base will only grow sub, so it will grow sublinearly. So it'll be at a slower rate. So whilst I'm not saying we won't add people to the top co, it will be at a lower rate than the acceleration of the business lines. So the thesis at least is at a certain point you become, again, within kind of 6 to 12 to 18 months, you become quite cash flow generative. And you should be, because you're buying them, right? If you're buying profitable businesses and you lose money for too long, what are you doing? In our case, there is this kind of central tech platform that does need to be subsidized. And we think around the 12 to 18 mark, that will comfortably be the case. It might actually be sooner, but I don't want to speak out of turn. I believe it might be a lot sooner. But nonetheless, we're committing to it definitely being true by the kind of end of next year.
You know, what you really need to do is figure out how to pull up Berkshire Hathaway and build yourself a big cash float, maybe buy an insurance company.
We've talked about that. Maybe vouchers or some sort of credit business. Very, very excited by that idea. I don't know if I have the ability to run an insurance business, but you know, investing the float would be fun.
Yeah. So I wouldn't say this was like chapter two in the sense that the chapter's closed, because this chapter's still very much open. But you did say that you aren't the CEO of this business as one of your, as kind of your third goal. And if I were to have to predict what your chapter three is, it's the new ventures, and that's new spelled N-E-U as your sort of incubation.
It's kind of the way that most of Europe spells the word new, and yet no one can pronounce it, although you did pronounce it. It's new A. So once again, that's a branding mistake on my part. I have to rethink that one, but nonetheless.
Well, it could be a direct line to new ventures. This is where you're incubating your new ventures.
That was the thesis, yeah.
And one of them is looking deeply into the future of what this industry looks like. Now, everything that AMP is doing is sort of acquiring and rolling out profitable startups that serve the current paradigm of software and how we've known e-commerce to function over the past 5 years and today, and certainly for another number of years.
Yeah.
But I'm really curious to go a little bit deeper into this vertical SaaS thesis that you'd shared in the past, and thinking about, like, in fact, if software becomes so much easier to build that almost anybody in the world can spin up a very customized specific software business to serve their very customized specific needs.
Yeah, yeah.
What does the platform look like for that?
My very nerdy phrase, and once again, I need some better branding, was like N of one software, which is everyone gets the software that's right for their business. Again, the backstory for that was with Tragico, we were inventory and order management, and we'd have a lot of people come to us because they heard the word inventory or they heard the word order management, and then say they had some expectation of how they could apply that to an existing business process that they had. And we would turn around and say, if you fit one of these three buckets, we're for you. But there are many, many, many different businesses out there and many different ways of doing things. This goes back to the NetSuite thing. Unless you're going to go to a NetSuite or an SAP and pay to have it massively customized or have something custom built, you couldn't really adapt software. We just talk about software being frozen. And I have a thesis, at least. I wouldn't say it's proven out yet, which is we're entering this world where, as you said, the cost of software is going to drop precipitously. It's gone from an art to a science, which therefore means the value of the software businesses, in theory at least, potentially drops somewhat.
And even let's double click on that. Like, why is it going to drop? I made that statement as if it's a given. It's AI. Why is it going to drop?
Well, it's partly AI, but also just think when something is really well understood, the profits get competed away. If everyone and their dog can see that SaaS is a high margin, again, air quote business, then you have a lot more entrants compete. And so you've gone from horizontal software. We're now in the age of vertical software, which is software really focused on a specific industry. You know, they're seeing Sense, which I think may have just raised $1 billion. Evaluation, which is software for dry cleaners. So we're seeing kind of software for everything. And they're now trying to find new ways to make money. They'll integrate payroll into it and payments into it. And so they're trying to capture more value, but the software itself is becoming a lower part of the value that they're offering. We're playing with the idea that we see a world where you have 10 or 100 times more software for every little niche category. These aren't businesses that should necessarily be funded. They could be a great 1, 2, 3, 4 million ARR software business, or it might just be a product that you've put inside your own business. Historically, it hasn't been accessible for an SME to have software crafted to their requirements. You have to rethink your business processes around existing software. And partly with AI, partly with some other innovations, we think we're about to enter a time when, I'm not going to say you're just going to chat to a screen, everything's going to be magical. But if you have some kind of pre-built modules, some pre-built blueprints of apps, you can kind of take a CRM, customize it to your need. Because realistically, what is the difference between a CRM for a nonprofit and a CRM for a golf club and a da-da-da-da-da? And so they're probably about 80% the same. And that last 20% is what has made distinct businesses successful historically through custom kind of focusing on those industries. But we think there is an opportunity potentially to kind of build what I will call my zero, my billion revenue, you know, business opportunity through building this kind of platform where 1,000 or 1,000,000 flowers bloom, which is, you know, tens of thousands of business applications are built either as SaaS products or for businesses themselves. I think the other one is just that it's just the cost drops. So you can have software do a lot more things inside your business. And again, I think it's also expectation. People want great software for their specific use case. Frankly, we still live in a world where most software is not great. In fact, most of it's pretty bad. We might not interact with ourselves. It's still out there. I mean, you walk into a big box retailer today and you look behind the screen, it might still be DOS. Definitely as in the airlines. So anyway, that's kind of where we're leaning towards.
One way I was trying to frame this to myself is when the first time we spoke about it was what Shopify was to e-commerce. It was just bringing people who were selling this incredible diversity of things. It could be, you know, dog food, it could be beers, it could be shoes, bringing that into the services industry such that people could be selling a vast array of services. It could be a roofing contractor, it could be anything.
Yeah.
And those people were being underserved by the specific software systems. And because now you could combine this platform with the ability to deeply customize the tooling they have. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's directionally correct. I mean, I go back to the point, which is like, if you run a hair salon, you have some online booking software for people to book appointments. If you run a podcasting studio, you have an online booking platform. We're kind of talking about the same thing, but that last 20% is distinctly different. And there are products that are appointment booking software for hair salons. Should there be a venture-backed business that's building appointment booking software for podcast studios? I don't know if that is a venture-backable business, but that product would be valuable to the subset of people that run podcasting studios. And so we think that, well, if you had the ability to spin up an appointment booking software platform, you know, on a platform like the one we're developing, and you could tweak that last 20% to make it specific to a podcasting studio, which is, hey, actually after the podcast's finished, we need to upload a terabyte of audio and video that can be accessible. Well, a hair salon doesn't have any kind of need to upload a terabyte of video and audio. And there's maybe three or four other things that are different, but otherwise it's kind of the same platform. But those last tweaks make it that bit more resonant with the podcasting studio business. And again, as I said, I don't know if that's the venture backable business and that it should be, but it would be great for that product to exist for those podcasting studios. And I think today that appointment software for a hair salon isn't modular, isn't customizable, couldn't be tweaked. And we think it's a bit of a shift. It's probably a lot more of a category creation than Trakeo ever was. People, inventory management software been for a long time. I'm effectively trying to imagine a world that doesn't exist today. We're used to software lurking and working and being developed a certain way. So it is a bit of a leap, but I can kind of squint and see this world where it exists. There's definitely some technical leaps we need to make before I would say we've achieved it. But I think it is appealing to me what the other side of that, you know, rainbow might look like and kind of the impact it could have.
To signpost this a little bit for you, is there any people in particular that you'd like to speak to? Anyone who's thinking about building vertical software for themselves that maybe they should be partnering with you to build it for? Or anyone that's providing one of these services?
The ICP, get back to that, which is something I need to better define, that I'm really enjoying engaging with is usually someone who has some sort of depth of knowledge in an industry, whether it's for their own business or other businesses, but usually for an industry, either because they're the CEO of a business and they've clearly identified an opportunity. They wouldn't necessarily be technologists, but they're probably technical by the definition of their depth of knowledge. And we call them usually tinkerers. So when we've talked to a lot of these people where they're like, you know, I run this business, I see this problem, I can't write code, I don't want to write code, but man, if there was a product that did blah, 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 my industry would love it. Mm. And we have these conversations all the time. And I'm like, you could build that. We could help you build that. Mm. And that's to me who I'd love to speak to. We've spoken to a lot of people with that profile. We're speaking to someone right now. I don't know the exact job title, but effectively he almost acts as, I think, a general contractor manager on a construction site. And there's the subcontractors and they have to kind of file or let him know when they need to be partially paid for the progress payments. And he wants to build a platform to do progress payments for construction sites. I'm like, makes sense. Understand that problem exists. Not something I deeply understand at all. Not a hugely complicated product. Most of these SaaS products aren't. They're CRUD apps. There's a bit of technical kind of requirements around payments, et cetera, and some scheduling stuff. But I'm like, that is an interesting product. And I can see that that's widely applicable to a specific industry. And he has that depth of knowledge for that industry. So he is uniquely able to support and develop it.
Or another way to look at this could even be how many ICPs you had back at TradeGecko, 36 of them, all the way from 32 of them, all the way from bright green, all the way through red, instead of just being TradeGecko's bright green. Each one of those could be their own individual vertical SaaS product.
I definitely look at what I'm doing and thinking I'm making some serious mistakes in terms of how broad we're trying. We could support. We're obviously trying to be very ruthless in our focus today. But then on the flip side, if you go to SAP, they have 16,000 modules and they'll build anything for anyone. So I would definitely say we are going to focus ruthlessly right now, but to build the vision we are considering, we are going to become quite a broad platform that serves lots of customer types. But do hard things because that's where the value is, right?
You can enable people to focus in the very specific things. I think that's how I'd get you out of that hole if I had to. The other shout out was thinking about the frustrated salesperson who's out there talking to a customer who's saying, yes, I can sell you this thing, doesn't quite do what you need. But actually that person who truly deeply understands their market, they could be spinning off, starting their own company. And on the focus piece, so you sent me this snippet a little while ago, the David Friedberg focus talking about, you. Everyone assumes that there is this power law in the world that you're a passive participant in. And then there's this like underscored line, which is, you know, my job in life is to make the power law.
Make the power law,
You're an ambitious person. I'm really curious. We had some conversations about that word ambition. Tell me about the journey of an oak tree. Yeah, at what point in the life of an oak tree is it perfect? Like how much for you do you want to drive towards and achieve?
Yeah, I mean, eternally dissatisfied, right? So the oak tree comment was, I think, from another gentleman, Joe Hudson, I believe it was. And he says, yeah, when is an oak perfect? Is it when it's a seed, when it's a seedling, when it's a sapling, when it's a 10 years old, 100 years old? And I think the point being is there is no there. You're always in progress. Yeah, so ambition, how does it reflect? Look, I just have a lot of it. I don't know. I mean, it definitely drives a lot of frustrations, anxiety. My wife would kind of say it causes me to kind of be a bit frustrating for her to engage with sometimes. I think if I was to summarize where I'm at with that and my ambition is that I'm proud and excited. I don't have any concerns about it. Sometimes I don't like how it kind of exerts itself potentially mentally on me and my, you know, feelings about those things. Like, I don't have a problem with anxiety, but I don't want it to kind of immobilize me. And I think the thing I'm trying to figure out right now, when those things appear, like the anxiety or like, are we doing enough? Am I working hard enough? Are we going far enough, fast enough? Is to just kind of step back and acknowledge and appreciate the fact that I have the opportunity to do that. Because I'm very lucky that I can kind of, I could do anything or nothing. And what I want to do is I want to build really interesting products, work with great people, a lot or a little, a group of people, it doesn't really matter. And I want to do that forever. And so I think the thing that I spend a lot of time on and my ambition constantly drives me to think about is, have I done enough yet? And so just trying to reflect on where I've come from versus where I think I should be is probably the thing I'm trying to get better at. I'm not good at it. I'd like to be better, but I don't have any reason or desire to shrink or reduce or cap my ambition. That's not at all my intent.
As you've come back into New Zealand and started spending a little bit more time around, I'm curious about how that worldview meshes with the ambition that you feel or lack of in some cases in the country. Like, how would you speak to the ambitious New Zealander or what this ecosystem needs?
I think I'm more comfortable than the average New Zealander accepting and talking about my ambition. In certain people, it's there under the surface, and maybe it's less of a New Zealand thing to say it. But I'd say across the world, I don't think I'm unique, or a lot of entrepreneurs in New Zealand are unique. We're unique in contrast to some countries and obviously not to others. There are other countries where you also wouldn't want to speak loudly about your ambition. I would just suggest that, yeah, that's the case. The question is, by not being willing to talk about your ambition, are you constraining your ambition? Possibly. I'd have to think about that more. That'd be the biggest risk I would potentially perceive, is that if you're too public about it, do you once again get knocked down? I don't know if that's true though. I haven't thought about it enough.
Reminds me of this Paul Graham quote, this idea that ambitious people are rare. So if everyone is mixed together randomly, they tend to be, you know, as they tend to be early in people's lives, then the ambitious ones don't have ambitious peers. And when you take those people and you put them together with other ambitious people, they'll bloom like dying plants given water.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably the most ambitious people are starved for that sort of encouragement they get from ambitious peers. So the thing I felt when you said that is actually, well, it's not that the New Zealanders lack ambition. It's that because they aren't willing to talk about it with each other, they aren't able to find each other. They aren't able to bloom together.
I wouldn't have been able to put the words together like this when I was 24, but in hindsight, I felt like I had to leave New Zealand to get bigger. I kind of see like a dome. I don't know why in my head I visualize a dome and I feel myself kind of being constrained by it. That's not true. There's much more successful entrepreneurs here in New Zealand than myself. But I definitely felt that way. And it's probably what you said, because I didn't have the conversation. I didn't have the people around me. What 24-year-olds or 28-year-olds for that matter were willing and able to talk about the scale and scope of their ambition, or even to articulate it, because it is a difficult thing to put into words. And then part of me has thought, can I come back to New Zealand and make New Zealand bigger? And that's probably a level of arrogance as well. But no, I definitely feel it. Right now I'm in Kuala Lumpur, just having my third child, and I don't have a deep network of relationships there. And I miss that. When someone beside you who's, you know, a friend you've known for a long time, you know, built a great company or built some great product, and they're like, I'm really fascinated by this new ability to take hydrogen and convert it to methane and do a methanation process, or maybe I want to do a, you know, those little nuclear power plants that they're building, like there's something there. Or I mean, it's just the level of your ambition is always increased when you can see that people that you would, I mean, sometimes people are much smarter than us, right? But sometimes they're just people that are willing to be a bit more ambitious and talk about it.
As our friend Sean Gurley would put it, it's the making science fiction real.
Yeah, I mean, choosing great quests. And I think if all your friends are choosing quests that the gradient of that hill is too steep to climb up, and they're all like, but come on up, we're doing it. You're willing and able to do it as well. And I feel that a lot. I mean, I was in the States last year. I know you've lived there before. I love being a bit of a fire starter. Like I know that I created a lot of joy for myself and for my team in small groups, really kind of pumping them up, amping them up. And I know that's something that I really enjoy. And I think my teammates that used to work with me enjoyed. And that's why one of the reasons I'm not a big fan of remote work, because I do think ambition, fire starting, getting amped, getting pumped, it was really hard to do without body language, without being in person. And so look, New Zealand needs more of it. We could all do with more of it. I definitely could do with more of it in my life. I'm trying to invest in creating those moments.
You mentioned the family. How you think about these sorts of things with the view to building a family and imbuing those sorts of values in your kids? I know they're still young, so it's still early days.
It's an interesting question, right? I think my eldest is about to turn 6, 3 and 5 weeks old or what have you. I would say I'm conscious of it. I'm thinking about the general problems. I haven't really dove into any tactical solutions for it yet. I encourage my children. The one thing I am doing and I'm quite excited by and I'm enjoying is if my kids get obsessed about it, I encourage them to be as obsessed as they possibly can about something. So if they're obsessed about dinosaurs, let's go all the way in. How deep can this dinosaur obsession take it? But that's about as far as I've gone. I love this idea. I've read it before. When they're older, I'm interested in this. Okay, let's go find the best person in the country country who's interested in, who knows how to do that thing, get them to come talk to you. Like, I would love to encourage extremes. I think pointy people are great. I think the worst thing I could be is mediocre for myself. And so pointiness is I think, a really great thing to have in a human being.
Some personal version of the hiring principle that you should be hiring for strengths, not lack of weaknesses.
Yeah, exactly. That's a nice way of putting it. Maybe it's a bit more polite than mine.
I like it. Shifting into a final section of this conversation, and you've already done a little bit of this just in terms of the how can we help you. So there was the blocks that people thinking about vertical SaaS and software. What are you looking for in your life right now? I think you're sort of trying to figure out where to live, or what are the things that the great expat community could be directing to you?
It's an interesting thing when you sell a company. I had a single child at the time, very young. It was COVID and I sold my company. I felt it was quite untethering. Like, I wasn't tethered any longer. Disorientating would be another word I used. To be honest, kind of since then, which was end of 2020, it wasn't all at once, but I've been floating a little bit. There's one thing that I really love the quote of, which is, you know, freedom is a river you want to swim across, and anchor yourself to the other side, not an ocean you want to live in, because it is. Mm. It's not a great place to be. The problems I'm facing are my own problems to solve, frankly. I mean, the thing that I continue to look for and continue to invest in is building deep relationships with people that are inspiring and hopefully that I can give inspiration to, whether it's entrepreneurs or people trying to figure out their next steps, because that's where I'm at. I'm trying to figure out the next big steps. But I'm well aware that action begets information. So that's why I'm building at the moment, you know, helping co-found one company that's going well and kicking off and incubating another business whilst also exploring all the other interesting opportunities out there. Yeah, it's hard to say there's something specifically someone could come give me, but I mean, I'm always fascinated by people doing big and interesting and great quests.
It's a beautiful place to wrap it up. Cam, thanks. That was a really fun conversation. I'm looking forward to getting this one out to the world.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. As a quick reminder, make sure you hit subscribe in your favorite podcast player so you can keep getting stories like this landing your feed every Friday, power you through those weekend chores. I want to give a quick shout out to the boys at Supermix who do all our editing. Zach and Xavier are Kiwi expats themselves. They're building a thriving business in the heart of New York City. A lot of respect. Not a sponsor, just a happy customer here. Also, for my day job, I'm an entrepreneur in residence and an investor at Blackbird Ventures. We're backing the best Kiwi founders wherever they are in the world. My personal sweet spot is pre-seed and seed. I like to say no check is too early, so drop me a line anytime. It's dbooth@blackbird.vc. We'll look forward to seeing you back next week.